From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week we talked to musician, producer, and record label president Don Was.
I'm just attracted to artists who have a vision, but maybe don't actually know how to accomplish it, and to help them realize what's in their head.
Plus, we review new music from indie rocker Superchunk and rapper Dessa. I can tell you firsthand,
I know how that glove fits. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later on, Jim, we are going to talk in depth with Don Was about his career as a producer and record label president. But first, we've got some new music to review.
That is a little bit of Superchunk, What a Time to Be Alive, the title track of album number 11. From a band that pretty much defines indie rock for the last couple of decades, Greg. Superchunk came together in Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1989 around singer-guitarist Mac McCaughan and bassist Laura Balance. When I say defined indie rock for an entire generation, they are, of course, also the duo behind Merge Records, one of the most important indie labels of the last 30 years, really. Staying resolutely independent that entire time, this 11th album is different in many ways from the Superchunk catalog. It is political for the first time, really, for this pop punk power pop, however you want to define them, indie rock band. They are talking about the Trumpian moment. We're going to dive in and give our reviews in a second. They are working with Jim O'Rourke, renowned indie rock producers, worked with Wilco and Sonic Youth. Let's play a song and then we'll give our opinions. This is a song called Reagan Youth. It is referring to a hardcore punk band of the 80s, but also much more. Superchunk on Sound Opinions. That is Reagan Youth from the new Superchunk album, What a Time to Be Alive. Jim, this band was so ubiquitous in the 90s with their tours and their albums. It seems, though, when they put a record out, there's a real purpose behind
it. They've got something to say.
You know, a few years ago, their previous record, I Hate Music, had a similar kind of tone. You know, you're at midlife. You're questioning music's purpose amid these demoralizing grown-up realities. It was a more contemplative album by Superchunk standards.
Yeah.
I think What a Time to Be Alive is basically addressing the same kind of issues. What is music's role at this demoralizing time in our lives? And instead of being contemplative, it just roars. It is coming out of the box in a feisty mood, to say the least. I've never heard Mac McCann so worked up. I mean, he's literally saying, fight me, because I'm so riled up about this stuff. Five of the 11 songs are under 3 minutes. It's a classic punk rock record. I think they're returning the favor to a lot of the bands like Reagan Youth, who inspired them when they were kids growing up in the 80s, which was a very demoralizing time for young people in this country. A nuclear war seemed on the horizon. The potential of a draft was on the horizon.
It was not morning in America for everybody.
And I think they were inspired by the bands they heard then, like Reagan Youth. It's interesting in that song, you know, it acknowledges not only the role that that band played in encouraging people that they can get through this, it also acknowledged the presence of that conservative political organization.
Let me tell you the truth. There was more than one Reagan Youth. Yeah.
And which in many ways is, as you know, that those Reagan Youths have grown up to become the America that we know today, or at least the people who are running America today. You know, some people have said, oh, it's like preaching to the choir, you know. But some of the responses I heard to that were, well, the preacher needs the choir, and the choir needs that preacher. I think the album ends on a very appropriate thread. It's the longest song on the record. It's anthemic, Black Thread, Cut the Black Thread. And it's basically saying, we can get through this. There is light at the end of this tunnel. And it's It's a really powerful record. I tell you, I needed this record when it came out. The day I listened to it was one of those days where you're just going, everything's wrong.
Yeah.
It was a powerful antidote to all that. I'm giving it a buy it.
I will second a very enthusiastic buy it, Greg. It's one of the best Superchunk has ever given us. I think that Reagan Youth does a couple of things, and it epitomizes the album. It's also, you know, Mac McCann is asking, you know, did we accomplish anything? 50 sweaty teenagers in a room, pogoing, slam dancing to a hardcore punk band. Does that accomplish anything? Well, you know, in times of such huge crises politically in America, if we want to talk about global warming and our planet dying, you know, what can you do? Well, one thing you can do is get motivated, and sometimes that's jumping up and down and sweating and singing along. The melodies on this album, you know, even in a song like Break the Glass, which is urging you to put your head or your fist or the hammer, they're talking about, through the window. Don't open the window. Put your head through it. You know, that is the start of a response. We're living at this time where teenagers are gathering to fight this cavalier attitude in America toward guns. You need a song. Songs are the motivation, and this is an album of motivating songs. It's just a great listen, beginning to end. I've put my time in now. I'm vetted, uncontested. See how an honest answer shuts down. I'm asking trick questions. I'm out here arms wide, hiding nothing. I've done it all in broad daylight, and I left the cameras running. I'm famous and the ash. Red eyes shining in the camera flash. My secret is I don't keep on. See something, go ahead and say something. I ain't afraid of it. I don't drown, won't stay down.
That is a track called 5 out of 6 from the new Dessa album called Chime. Minneapolis artist named Margaret Wander studied philosophy at the University of Minnesota and came up as a writer and a poet, got into the poetry slam scene, that morphed into the hip-hop scene in Minneapolis. She was soon signed to that very well-respected hip-hop label, Doomtree, out of Minneapolis, and has collaborated with numerous artists on that label. She was also handpicked by the Hamilton team to be part of that very successful mixtape that that came out about a year ago. At the same time, she's put out four studio albums. Chime is her fourth. And she takes her time between records, and with good reason. She's a thinker. She admits freely to, you know, seeing philosophy is just rigorous daydreaming. And poems poems are sort of an extension of that, and lyrics are just an extension of that as well. So she's creating this sort of seamless world where she thinks through things before she puts them down on tape. Chime is an example of that. We're going to play a song from it before we review it. It's called Fire Drills. From Dessa on Sound Opinions.
I've been Wendy, living with the lost boys. Youth spent as a deckhand on the convoy. Moved every night to prove we were something. Got confused if it was from a two that we were running. I've seen Gibraltar, I've seen the Taj Mahal. Soweto, Hagia Sophia, Chef Shaolin paints the walls blue. I've played to full rooms, I've played the fool too. Burning through the bottoms of a pair of new boots. Cut my hair, take my stick down. A woman on her own must be from out of town. Funny you don't know the concessions that you're making until you catalog them. And by then they're many, and your battle-hardened heat makes liquid of the asphalt. Keepsakes and parking tickets on the dashboard. I'm here to file my report as the vixen of the wolf pack. Tell patient zero he can have his rib back. Can't be too broke to break. As a woman, always something left to take. So you shouldn't try to stay too late or talk to strangers. Look too long, go too far out of range. Cause angels can't watch everybody all the time. Stay close, hems low, safe inside. That formula works if you can live it. But it works by putting half the world off limits.
That is Fire Drills by Dessa, the Minneapolis, now part-time New York resident rapper. She is a writer, Greg. She's put out a book. She's a philosopher. She is a force of nature. I love this record. I think that this is also very much an album for this time. Mm-hmm. If we think about what that title means, Chime, she's inviting us to chime in. Everybody chime in. Even you, with all your imperfections and your conflicts and your self-doubts, this is an album that is trying to balance self-empowerment with sensitivity. You know, and I think actually Shrimp, which is 40 seconds long, it's kind of a toss-off, right? You know, has some of the best lines here. I've been as bad as good girls get. Mm-hmm. I'm always a bridesmaid, never an astronaut. That's a line she laughs in the middle of.
Yeah. Always a bridesmaid, never an astronaut.
Okay. She's wondering where she fits in. Someone who loves backpacks more than purses. And she's questioning all these things, including some very heavy ones. They say there's good grief, but how can you tell that from the bad? This is an album that is sexy as well as an album that is angry. It's an album that is sensual as well as an album that is very eggheady. I mean, find another rapper, please, who can name drop St. Thomas Aquinas, okay? It is a brilliant, brilliant record, and it takes some time to really appreciate the depths. On the other hand, it's immediately apparent, you know, Fire Drills, wow, where a couple of weeks after the latest school shooting that starts with a fire drill, I think I hear it as getting ready for something bad to happen, but also welcoming it, because that's part of life too. It's a very enthusiastic buy it.
Yeah, Jim, I think she's a fascinating artist because she doesn't have a category. I mean, she's ostensibly signed to a hip-hop label, but she's doing a lot more than that. She's singing, she's rapping. The arrangements range all across the map. Velodrome, I would say, is more like a chamber pop song. It's got that beautiful cello arrangement with the piano chords and a distant sandpapery percussion.
I don't believe my will's quite free. I'm half machine, at least half steam. Aquinas, call on me. How many angels on the head of your pin?
Anybody they're straight up hip hop as well. There's there's straight up pop melodies on here that you could easily hear on a top 40 station. as you said, the content of this record, what she's thinking about, how she's bringing that philosopher's mind of hers into these lyrics is fascinating to me as well. I can't go on enough about Fire Drills. I think that is one of the best songs I've heard so far in this young year. And, you know, starting off with that hypnotic sitar riff at the start. Again, sitar on a hip-hop record. Okay, I'm down with that. It's a cool sound. It brings you in. This whole idea, like, how do women measure their lives today? And she's saying, in some ways, getting through a day without incident, without being harassed, without coming out alive even, is a win. And she's saying, if that's all there is, we're really living in a screwed up place. We need to have a better world than this, and we need to think more of ourselves in that.
At the same time, she can laugh at herself and admit to being boy crazy in what is a very effective, pop song.
That's the balance of it. And, you know, I'm more persuaded by her as a rapper than as a singer. I think, you know, the popular, more melodic vocal melodies inevitably don't separate her from the pop singer pack nearly as much as her rapping does. But I think it's a good counterbalance, as you say, to the heavier stuff that she does in a lot of the rap-oriented songs. I'm going to give it a buy it, too. I've been a fan since the start, and I think she is an artist who is definitely deserving of a wider audience. After a short break, we'll talk with musician, producer, and Blue Note Records chief Don Was. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that's a little bit of the song Spy in the House of Love by Was Not Was, the Detroit band that fused together elements of jazz, funk, pop, rock, you name it. You name a genre, it was in there, Greg. This week we're talking with Don Was, co-founder of that band, but so much more. He's also a revered producer, now the head of the Blue Note Records label, probably the most prestigious label in the history of jazz. But he started out in Detroit, in the suburbs, as Don Fagenson. Grew up loving local music, that included in Detroit the MC5 and the Stooges, and even Parliament Funkadelic once George Clinton relocated there. They formed the band Was Not Was, 1979, they being Don Was and his partner David Was, a.k.a. David Weiss. As we mentioned, he went on to become a masterful producer, working with the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt, Brian Wilson. That list just goes on and on.
Yeah, that's right, Jim. And then in, 2012, to become the president of Blue Note Records, talk about legendary labels. Wayne Shorter, Thelonious Monk, the jazz greats recorded for this label over the decades. Now he's running that label. So he's really lived the spectrum of the music industry. He's pretty much done about everything you can do in the music industry. Let's welcome performer, writer, producer, and label president Don Was to the show. Don, welcome.
Hey, thank you, guys.
That's an awful lot of hats to wear, Don. That's a lot of hats.
Oh, man. I got tired just hearing that.
Don, what a career in music you've had. You know, I think where we got to begin is give our listeners a sense of who you are and how you fell in love with music. What was it for you that got you into what really became your life, music?
Well, you know, I think you're born with a certain predilection towards it. But if I was looking for a pivotal sociological moment, I would probably go back to the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I was 12 years old. A lot of musicians my age, a lot of guys born in 1952, and that's because at 12 years old, it looked so cool. All the girls screaming, being in a band, dressing in those suits.
Close your eyes and I'll be
I was just young enough to think, yeah, maybe I could do that. And if I was any younger, it wouldn't have looked appealing. Any older, I'd have probably been a little more sensible and thought, be fun to do that, but perhaps I should back it up with law school. I really believe that bands are metaphorical for life, kind of, you know, the way that a band interacts. It's not that different from a basketball team, in fact. You know, I think that's why sports are so popular. You have people interacting, cooperating, and making great things happen as a result that they couldn't do on their own. And I think that's kind of a utopian situation. Everybody wants to be part of that. And I think genetically we're made to be part of a tribe. But there's something about a band that it replicates tribal living and a family, really.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, Don, because I was reading an old interview with you where I believe you mentioned that Brian Wilson once described your bass playing as like you play like a guy in a band. Mm-hmm. And, yes. You know, it was, is that a compliment or not? But I think I think he meant it as a compliment, like you described this notion of being a team player. And, yeah. You know, was that the way in? Okay, I want to be part of this gang. I want to be part of this group.
Yeah, and playing music. There's something that happens. It still happens. I got to tour in a band with Jamie Johnson and Warren Haynes and Michael McDonald and Taj Mahal and Dr. John, a whole bunch of guys, and we did the last waltz, right? We did that. We played in Chicago. And it was just the greatest experience to be up there playing those songs every night. In fact, it was really loud on stage, and I thought about playing with these musicians. If I gotta get a ringing in my ears, let it be from this.
Yeah.
And I was just so happy doing it night after night. I could play those songs and play with those guys forever.
I don't want to skip Was Not Was. Because Greg and I are huge fans, right?
And, yeah, you've been very kind over the years. I'm both of you. I appreciate
it. Well, this notion of you know, you grow up outside of Detroit, Oak Park. You meet your brother, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, meet your brother.
Mm-hmm. Brother from another planet, right?
This idea of we are going to put Parliament Funkadelic together with the MC5. I mean, what kind of notion? Who thought this was a good idea? Well, you and David.
Well, you know, if you grew up in Detroit when we did, it's a perfectly natural combination. We were just really reflecting our roots the same way everybody else does. It was a great time to grow up in Detroit. I had a pivotal moment once when I went downtown to the print shop in the 60s. I was in high school. And Pharoah Saunders and his band had been performing in town, and they came over to this print shop. And they were jamming with the MC5.
Hmm. Wow.
And it was music that I'd never heard before. Really, I'd never heard again. But it shaped my whole outlook on it. And it certainly reinforced the notion that doing something that hasn't been done before is a noble pursuit in music. That's something it's hard to do. It gets harder and harder to do because so many things have been done. But just to don't play the same thing that everyone played before. Don't put the same musicians together.
Yeah.
So we just called Detroit guys who we knew who came in and played on the stuff. And what came out is what came out. But it's very Detroit to me.
Well,
it's
pretty
natural.
And the sense of humor there in everything you always did. And that's rare.
When we were in love, I pretended that you didn't exist. That way, I loved you more. You suggested we get married and move into a house. I suggested that we jump overboard and live underwater in the lost city of Atlantis, where mermaids sing and tuxedo dolphins bring you breakfast.
Rock and roll, as broadly as we define it, is so much about being cool all the time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you guys never seem to care about being cool.
I just think we were who we are, you know. I don't think it's an advantage, by the way, to be funny in rock and roll. I'm not sure people go for that. I think people want rock and roll to be honest and serious. They look to music in general to help them make sense out of their lives. I'm not sure that being funny, I mean, that entertains and that's got value, but I don't know that's always the paramount goal.
It might have been a bad word choice on my part.
No, but there was a joy
more. I mean, you know, you guys were having fun.
We had fun, and that was impossible.
Not, you know, because the Stooges didn't project having fun. You know, Clinton didn't project having fun. Parliament Funkadelic. Yeah. You know, but was about fun.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we had fun on stage. There were also something, you know. One time we played in Mobile, Alabama. A cab driver picked me up, made me sit up front. He was pretty out of his skull, and he was going off on racial issues. And I just thought, I do not get into it with this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stay away.
Just get to the airport. So finally he asked what I was doing there, and I said, we played at the arena tonight in a band called Was Not Was, and he got really quiet. This is a white guy. Right? Mm. He gets really quiet, and then he apologized for all the racial stuff he was talking about to another white guy because he'd seen our band, the vision of our – we never dotted the I and had a song called Why Can't We All Get Along or anything. It was just the visual of seeing all these different cats from different backgrounds on stage having fun playing together sent a powerful statement about people getting along. We didn't have to sing about it. We embodied it. And that was really – that guy apologizing to me was it validated everything that we'd done. If nothing else ever happened, if that was the only thing that happened, it was worth doing the band for them.
When the sun comes down, they hit the streets. In the bars, they try to meet some other stranger. Ease the pain of living alone till it drives them insane. The woodwork squeaks, and out come the freaks. Yeah, the woodwork squeaks, and out come the freaks.
Woodwork squeaks.
The other thing that strikes me about Was Not Was, Don, was that you were kind of bucking a trend where everything had to fit into its slot. I mean, I remember when on the Born to Laugh at Tornadoes album, when that came out, and I saw Mel Torme and Ozzy Osbourne listed as vocalists on that record. Yeah. I go, there is no other band on the planet that would have those two guys on the same record.
You can't stare into the sun, you can't. Pretend to have fun. You can't read a robot's mind, can't expect vultures to be kind.
Thought it was some kind of cosmic joke, and I read interviews with you around that time where you were saying, no, we got Mel Torme on that record because we really like his stuff. And, you know, then I started listening to him more seriously after that and realized, oh, that is kind of a cool voice, and that is a cool way that they use them. But I think what Jim was getting at when you guys were, you know, kind of the more fun, jokey side of the group was that sort of thing where you think it's a practical joke or it's tongue-in-cheek, but there's a little more substance to it than maybe is apparent on the surface.
Well, I'll go with that. I like that.
But what about Mel and Ozzy? I mean, again, the thinking on that, you had to know that somebody was going to get a chuckle out of that just looking at the credits.
Well, we got a chuckle out of out of doing it. You know, I think that's – it was such a trip. You know, David was a freelance jazz critic for the now-defunct L.A. Herald Examiner. And he'd written a really great review of Mel Torme at the Hollywood Bowl. And Mel found him, called him up, and he said, Leonard Feather's been hating my music for decades. This is the first time my children have been able to read a nice review of their dad playing in town. He said the words that sealed his fate. He said, you got a marker on me, babe.
I owe you.
So David called me right up. He said, what do we do? So we had that song. It's called Zaz Turned Blue.
Zaz had red hair. He didn't care. He always laughed loud He wasn't proud, just a real easy guy who wouldn't tell a lie. But then one day, Zaz turned blue.
And he got into it. I think he was really trying to be like the successful uncle helping his ne'er-do-well nephews out, giving him a break in showbiz, right? Which was incredibly generous, and he was, in fact, doing that. He found nuance and meaning in that song that we didn't know what was there. And also, we didn't know how he was going to do it. We went to the studio, and we'd certainly never been in a studio with an artist of that magnitude, right? And he had worked something up with his piano player. And if we didn't like it, I didn't know how we were going to direct him or change anything. But that's take one. He had really worked it up, and they put considerable time into it. And I couldn't believe it. It was just a brilliant interpretation. I got really choked up at the session. And then afterwards, David and I, we had a boombox, and we were just walking up and down Miami Beach and playing the cassette over. And we couldn't believe that it happened. That our song had come to life like that.
Yes, as turned blue. What were we supposed to do?
When we come back, we'll talk to Don Was about his success producing albums for artists such as the Rolling Stones and Bonnie Raitt, and what it's like to go from musician producer to record label president. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a song called Thing Called Love by Bonnie Raitt from her 1989 album Nick of Time. This week we're talking to the producer of that record, Don Was. Don was the bassist in the Detroit band Was Not Was, but a lot of people know him for his role as a producer. He's worked with a lot of major artists in his career, including people like Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, the B-52s, plenty more. But I want to focus on that Bonnie Raitt period in particular because her story is so unique. She was in a tough time in her career when Don started working with her. She had been one of the most revered artists of the 70s, that singer-songwriter era. She was a noted interpreter of songs from the blues and folk vernacular, great guitar player, but she was kind of lost at sea in the 80s for a good part of it. She'd lost her label deal. Now she was looking for her next move. Lo and behold, she records Nick of Time with Don Was, and that wins multiple Grammys, sells millions of copies. Suddenly, Bonnie Raitt's back on the map. So I asked Don, what was his approach to working with her at that point in her career?
I just loved her from, I bought her first album. Somehow I saw her at like the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival and in maybe 1969 or something. And I was just knocked out by her. I thought she was one of the best singers I'd ever heard. I loved all her records. I always loved her singing. I think she had gone through a transformation. I kind of believe that a kitty cat could have produced that album and it still would have been great. You know, she was just at that point in her life. She'd sobered up. She'd had to go through that transition where you stop trying to drown your emotions and you have to learn to purge them through art. And she'd put together a batch of really incredible songs and they were really honest and all I really tried to do is make sure the focus stayed on her vocals. I didn't have to tell her how to sing. And we just sort of maintained a really minimal level of accompaniment so that nothing got in the way. The goal on Nick of Time was to make it feel like you'd put the cassette player in the car and you were going for a ride. You're driving, and Bonnie Raitt's in the passenger seat with you singing into your ear. It was just capturing her. It wouldn't have worked with a lesser artist. Just feel really privileged to, you know, made 4 albums with her.
Were you surprised at the success of that record, though? It sounds like it was very modest intentions, and it just went through the roof.
All we wanted to do was, we wanted to do 2 things. We wanted to make a record we'd be proud of in 20 years, and number 2, we wanted to make the money back for the record company so they'd let us make another one.
Hmm.
The A&R guy was a guy named Tim Devine, and he came down one night. He said, "You got a tux?" I said, "No, I don't have a tux." He said, "Because you're going to need one for the Grammys." And I almost punched him. I thought, man, don't come down here with a bunch of hyperbole. If you like the record, say you dug it, you know, but don't give me that. There's no way we saw that coming. But in retrospect, you could see that the mood of the culture had shifted. We're just coming out of the era of Flock of Seagulls and Human League and all this electronic stuff, and it was time for something organic.
But
that
here
does happen.
We're also talking about a woman who was in mid-career. She was around, late 30s, 40s, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm. Closing in on 40.
Not a typical pop star, and yet there it was. I think people forget about the significance of that moment because I think it did a couple of things that people didn't think were possible at the time, and I think it opened up the door for a wave of female artists to resonate on the charts. A short-lived moment, perhaps, but a moment nonetheless that maybe we need to revisit a little more often.
Yeah, I think it's also the recognition that that everything isn't about teenagers and music, and that it was okay to sing about turning 40. Nick of Time is was a pretty brave song for a rock and roll artist to make. But she understood that there were a whole lot of people her age who were listening to music and then could no longer relate to teenage sensibilities and were going through. I think she just touched a really common nerve, but it took a lot of courage to be willing to do that.
I see my folks getting on.
Don, we've talked to so many great producers. They always have the best stories. Have you got a philosophy? Because we look at your production discography, you know, and the B-52s and Willie Nelson, you know, Dylan and Paula Abdul. You know, it's like, I mean, nobody. I think yours is singular in its diversity. So do you approach projects in a particular way or do you have a general philosophy?
I have a general philosophy that genres they're good for organizing record stores if you can find a record store. But musicians don't really think about your genre. If I'm playing bass, I don't think, all right, I'm going to play an R&B lick right here, and then I'm going to switch it up to jazz and 4 bars. It's conversation, whatever comes out of your head, which is whatever you've absorbed, kind of. It just bursts out of you, and you don't really think about that. So to me, there are 2 kinds of music. There's generous music and selfish music. And selfish music is some guy standing up there playing 1,000 notes a second, and basically all he's saying is, look at what I can do. And it's kind of like watching an acrobat. You can go, wow, that's quite an accomplishment. You must have practiced a lot, but it doesn't impact your life, or you know, you can appreciate the skill, but it's not touching you inside. And generous music is what we talked about a moment ago, where an artist digs deep inside and spills their guts musically and offers that up, which is a hard thing to do, by the way. It's not easy to dig inside and find something real to talk about and then to share that with strangers. But the strangers pick up on it, and it makes their lives better. So I think that transcends any kind of musical style or genre or certain whatever scales you're playing or modes your voice and the chords in. So I'm just attracted to artists who have a vision about how to go about doing that, but maybe don't actually know how to accomplish it, and to help them realize what's in their head. So that really, it doesn't matter if it's Mel Torme or Ozzy Osbourne, you know. They both have something to say. They both have a way they want to say it. And the actual methodology of expressing yourself is fairly common for all musicians. It's just, I've been lucky to work with really great, expressive, soulful artists. And that's kind of what I look for.
So I take a little bad with the good. It ain't just black and white. You gotta deal with the real.
You know, there have been a lot of veteran artists that you've worked with, and I think you got a lot of credit, justifiably so, for helping them find who they really were or what their true voice was, and making a record that sort of represented that in a way after a lot of people had written them off. And Bonnie Raitt's a great example. The B-52s. Mm-hmm. I would even say Iggy Pop. The Brick by Brick record came at a time when, you know, that sort of Bowie halo that had been cast around him for a number of years sort of faded, and he was kind of wandering in the wilderness a little bit too. Do you sort of sense that these artists already know that's an issue and are just looking for somebody to be a conduit, or do they come to you for guidance on these sort of things? Is there any psychological therapy involved in what you're doing, as well as, you know, being an engineer and recording a good studio record?
Yeah, I think the psychology of it is, you know, 90% of it. Not in the sense that you're trying to trick somebody into doing something or anything, but in understanding where they're coming from. You know, this reminds me of a conversation I had with John Mayer, who I've done two records with and who I really like. He's a good friend. But one night he said to me, why is it that a lot of people seem to come to you to do the album after the one that's the big hit? And I looked at him funny. I didn't know if he was like picking a fight. Or I didn't know quite how to take it, but I thought about it. And I thought, all right, well, sometimes you have a big hit, like Was and I Was did. We had a hit with Walk the Dinosaur, which is maybe the least representative song that we cut in over five albums. But that was the one we were known for. After that, you know, for an artist, is usually, well, how do I get back on track after? I like the commercial success, but where was I before that interruption?
Yeah,
and I like to think that that's something that I can bring to the proceedings.
A guy who has spent many years in interviews saying, generally, I saw record companies as the enemy. In fact, you know, big New York Times profile, you're named president of Blue Note, and you said, yeah, I always thought the record company was the enemy. Now you're running not only a record company, Don, but Blue Note, you know, founded in the late 30s, cornerstone label in jazz.
Well, you know something? It was a real fluke, man. I was in New York making the first of the John Mayer records, Born and Raised, and we had one night off, and I looked at the Village Voice, and I saw that a singer that I really dug, a guy named Gregory Porter, was playing at a little bar up on the, almost in Harlem, called Smoke. So I went up there just to listen, you know, no business intended. I drank coffee, ate ribs, and stayed for all three sets. It was one of the greatest performances I'd seen in my whole life.
I found out on my way to Harlem, Ellington, you don't live around here.
he moved away one day, so they say, from Harlem.
The next morning, by chance, I'm having breakfast with an old buddy of mine who I knew as when he was a drummer in the 90s, and he ended up marrying my assistant, the woman who worked for me in the 90s, and he'd gone from being Sheryl Crow's drummer to being the president of Capitol Records. And we were really just talking about old times. It wasn't about music at all. But as the breakfast ended, I said, is Blue Note Records still part of Capitol Records? Because if it is, you should sign this guy that I saw last night, Gregory Porter. He's awesome. And what I didn't know was that EMI at the time was thinking of closing down Blue Note. Bruce Lundvall, who'd run the company so brilliantly for 30 years, was retiring. He was in bad health. And no one seemed to have a vision for how to keep the aesthetic intact, but moving forward. And I walked in with an idea on the day that they were trying to decide whether to close the company. So he offered me the job. And I was like, don't even put this temptation in front of me, man. I don't want to work at a record. I didn't want to work anywhere. My goal in life had been to get through it without having a job. You know, yeah. I never thought about it. Producing records or recording or playing bass as being work, you know. But it was irresistible. So I took the gig, and I was woefully unprepared for it. I didn't know anything about getting organized. I walked into Capitol Tower. It was like a cartoon, man. They gave me the thing of pencils and a phone.
And stapler.
What do I do?
Yeah.
George Constanza in the New York Yankees office, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was exactly, yeah. It was comical. But you start figuring out what to do. I think it's an asset that I didn't know what to do, and that I had to rely on being a musician and knowing how to make records. You know, there's a manifesto that the founders of Blue Note Records wrote in 1939, where it's a good lefty reading position statement about really how they're dedicated to the pursuit of authentic music and creating an environment where artists can have uncompromising freedom of expression. Yeah. So I thought, all right, well, let's just do that. I'm just your food.
Mentioned you signed Gregory Porter, and there's some other interesting artists: Candace Springs, Jose James. Yeah. These are artists who are making these kind of genre blurring records that it represent a new generation of music that I think is very much in that Blue Note tradition you were talking about, Don.
And yeah, I agree.
And yet, still having time to produce records on the side, notably a record that Jim and I were, if we could do cartwheels, we would have been doing them. The Blue and Lonesome record by the Rolling Stones, because it's like the best Rolling Stones record we've heard. And I think the record that a lot of Rolling Stones fans were hoping that they would one day get around to making again. What was your take on how they were, how this happened? A classic blues album from the Rolling Stones in 2016.
Well, if we had discussed it ahead of time, it never would have happened. It's certainly something that was always on the radar, but distant. What happened was we started cutting some new songs, and we went into a great studio in London. And we'd never been in that studio before. It took a minute to get used to the headphones and the sound of the room. And so just to clear everybody's heads, Keith said, let's do Blue and Lonesome. So we did one take of it. It's the one that's on the album. And it was like shockingly great. Right. Yeah. And thankfully, Chris Sharma, the engineer, hit record, and everyone knew it was great. We came in, we played it back, and then it's just, hey, let's do another one.
I'm blue on all
songs as a man.
And at the end of the first day, we had like six songs. And still no one talked about making a blues album. But we came back the next day and did more blues. And we came back a third day, and Eric Clapton, who was working in the other room and had been ducking in and checking it out, he came in and played a couple songs. And then we finished the time that we had booked, and still no one talked about a blues album. It was kind of like when a guy's pitching a no-hitter, you don't talk to him about it.
You're going to jinx it, yeah.
No one mentioned blues album. And then we waited a couple of months, and then Chris and I went in and did some rough mixes, which pretty much ended up being the mixes that are on the album.
That's phenomenal.
And then just send it to the guys, and then the discussion began in earnest. So it was a really natural musical outburst.
Well, do that again, Don.
Guys, why don't we just warm up a little bit and see what happens, right?
Yeah.
Old producer's trick.
Well, it has been a joy talking to Don Was. Thank you so much for coming on Sound Opinions, Don.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure.
That wraps up our conversation with musician, producer, and Blue Note label president Don Was. Now we want to hear from you. Do you have an opinion on Don Was's incredible career or anything else in the world of music? Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, award season is winding down, and we're going to pick some of our favorite film soundtracks.
As always, Sound Opinions was produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, and Ayanna Contreras.
Would someone please hang that phone up?
Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Hey, this is Paul calling from Los Angeles, California. I'm calling regarding the recent cover songs episode. One great cover that comes to mind that totally redoes the original and sheds new light on it is Saint Etienne's cover of Only Love Can Break Your Heart by Neil Young. It's kind of a monumental reworking, and maybe the best example I can think of is a cover that sheds entirely new light on the original. Thanks a lot. Enjoy the show.
Hey, Jim and Greg, it's Philip from Dallas, and I think the ultimate I Want You Back song is Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Ooh Baby Baby. That moment when he says, I'm just about at the end of my rope.
I'm just about at the end of my rope, but I can't stop trying.
I can't sing like Smokey Robinson, but the sound of desperation in his voice is just palpable. Anyways, love your show. Keep up the good work.
For the ones who died. Yeah. Yeah. My name is Michael Sykes. I'm an African-American pastor, and I'm listening to your show with Sir Baptist. What I wanted to say is that this is an eye-opening episode that you have chosen to produce.
What if Trayvon was the next Martin Luther and just arrived early to the shooter? What if Hadia had an idea, but it died in the park? She could have been Rosa. What if Eric Garner was just another warning? What if I'm wondering, what if these what ifs are just waiting for us to wake up?
It gives me a new insight into how I might approach millennials in terms of ministering to them.
Before it's too late, we gotta wake up.
We can change.
Hey, my name's Katie. I'm calling from Seattle, and I'm loving the show tonight. I think there's absolutely room for spiritual things in pop music. I think it's vital. And, you know, there's a lot of diversity of opinions, particularly around spirituality. But I think anything that puts it out there in an honest way, it's a part of the human experience. I think it's awesome that it's happening in music. It's awesome that it's something that we can be real about in our art. So, yeah, keep up the good work. I'm loving it tonight. Thanks.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.